The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. When Dr. Seuss's Pea Soup Grinch stood at the top of Mount Crumpet and looked down at Whoville, he marveled at the nature of Christmas. He had taken all of the Whos' presents away, their stockings, their trees, their ornaments, and yet Christmas came anyway. It came without ribbons, he said. It came without tags.
It came without packages, boxes, or bags.
As the Grinch discovered, Christmas, like all the other wintry holidays, isn't really about gifts. But let's be honest, December 25th does tend to come with ribbons, tags, packages, boxes, and bags. Abundantly, and often all at once. So today on Word of Mouth, it's the gift show. Not your ordinary laundry list of what and what not to buy, but an exploration of presents, past and future. I'm here today as a little gift to our usual host, Virginia, who is here today, technically, but has sadly lost her voice. Say hi, Virginia.
Hi.
I'll just take it from here, okay?
Thank you so much. There's a gift of the Magi message here, losing my voice as a radio host.
Yeah, well, luckily we taped most of these interviews earlier this week. Anyway, we're beginning the show with those treasured rags of youth, the ones that arrive in your mailbox filled with pages upon pages of gadgets and toys. Even among the glittering and cozy wares in most magazines, one stands out, the Neiman Marcus Christmas book. It offers the luxurious, the fantastic, and the frankly bizarre. 2016's fantasy gift collection is no exception. From walking the red carpet at the Grammy Awards to his and her island cars designed by Lily Pulitzer, it offers the kind of stuff adults might dream up if they let their imaginations run wild. But how does a fantasy gift guide even get dreamed up? To find out, Virginia spoke with Ginger Reeder, VP of Corporate Communication for Neiman Marcus, where she also curates the famous Fantasy Gifts collection.
Ginger, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So this is the Christmas book's 90th anniversary. How did it begin?
Originally, it was a small gift book that was sent as a holiday greeting to good customers. And I've actually got the original one. It's like 4 inches by 3 inches. It had 78 items sketched in the Christmas book, and it was literally sent out as a holiday greeting just to remind our customers to come in and shop.
Well, this year, there's a $1.5 million Cobalt Valkyrie X airplane. Looks like an all-copper exterior. It's quite beautiful.
Yes, it's actually rose gold wrap.
Well, of course.
Why not?
What's the most expensive gift ever offered?
The most expensive gift ever offered was a $33 million Boeing business jet, and the most expensive gift ever sold was a $6.9 million Neiman Marcus Edition Bell helicopter.
Oh, well, okay. So it is called the Fantasy Gift Book.
I
wondered, you know, do you really sell many of these items?
We typically sell about half of the fantasy gifts, and I have given up trying to predict which ones are going to sell because I've worked with them, you know, for over 9 months or longer, sometimes longer, and so I have favorites, and I don't want to, you know, choose favorites.
I'm not going to ask you to tip your hand, Ginger.
No, that's all right. Typically, we sell about half of them, and the idea behind the fantasy gifts was in the late 1950s when Stanley Marcus, who was the son of the founder of Neiman Marcus, took over the company upon his father's death. He was getting phone calls from news outlets all around the world asking, "What are you crazy Texans doing for Christmas?" And a couple of times he had an answer so he could say, well, there was a gentleman who bought all of the downtown store windows and had them reproduced in his living room on Christmas morning. And other times he didn't have a story like that, so he thought, we should come up with these wild, over-the-top gifts, because as we expand outside of Texas, our fame will be known for, you know, oh yes, that's the company that also sells his and her airplanes, or, and we wouldn't have to spend quite so much money on advertising.
So there you go. I forget. Texas, an important element in all of this.
Yes.
But there is a kind of cheekiness in the descriptions, right? There's the for the optimist, a bracelet that brightens the future. For the pessimist, a mattress with a built-in lock box. I mean, you look at these things, it's pretty much a guide for the 1% or even the 1% of the 1%.
Well, I mean, again, it's all about fantasies. And just because, you know, we have grown up does not mean that our fantasies have necessarily changed. So, you know, when we were all children, you had that anticipation at the holiday season of, am I going to get a new bike? Am I going to get a Barbie dream house? What am I going to get? And now we've just notched them up a little bit. But certainly we are presenting these with tongue firmly planted in cheek.
Well, you're talking about things that we liked as kids, but this year's selection of fantasy gift includes a walk-on role for the Broadway musical Waitress, $30,000, a week traveling around English estates for $700,000. So it looks like you're leaning towards experiences rather than things. What led you in that direction?
Well, we've had good response to the experience, but we, you know, we still offer things. But the Waitress gift, I will say, was the very first fantasy gift to sell this year. So,
whoa,
yeah.
How do you guys even come up with them? Do you sit around and think, what are my daydreams?
Well, no, I get about 200 proposals. I've been doing this now for 20 years, so people I've worked with in the past might send me a new proposal to consider for the coming year. But I get about 200. Proposals a year, some really far-fetched and some not so much. And some of them also come from our buyers who are traveling the world looking for, you know, great things to put in our stores and in the rest of the catalog. And then I narrow it down to about 30 that I present to a selection committee in early spring, and then we sort of arm wrestle to come up with the 10 that we think are the best.
What are some of the strangest, looking back, you know, strangest or favorite gifts from the fantasy gift collection?
Certainly, my favorites are always around books. And so in 1997, we did a collection of 90 great American novels. So there were 90 of them, all first editions, and it included things like, you know, The Great Gatsby, Gone with the Wind, Charlotte's Web. And if I had my druthers, that would have been the gift that I loved. Though I do love the Caldecott collection in this year's Christmas book.
I noticed that. Could you describe it to people?
Yes, it's 36 Caldecott Medal-winning children's books for $100,000, and they range from the very first year of the Caldecott Prize, which is 1938, all the way up to 2015. Yeah. So it's an extraordinary collection, and most of them are either first editions or early printings of a book. So obviously the one that most people are most familiar with is Make Way for Ducklings, and that one is signed, and it is a first edition.
I'm going through some. His and Her Sharp Ace, 1983. Double yes. Bathtub, 1966. Authentic Mummy Cases in 1971. Yes. What do you think one of the strangest was in your experience?
Well, I mean, the mummy cases were certainly strange, but the very first fantasy gift that we did was a Black Angus steer that you could either order on the hoof or in steaks. And much to our consternation, we sold one to a customer in South Africa where we found that we had to pay for it to be quarantined for 6 months before it could be delivered to the customer. So.
Okay. Again, Texas, I guess we.
Yes.
So now a portion of proceeds from many of the fantasy gifts goes to a public charity that Neiman Marcus operates. Is this a shift from early years, or has a portion always been?
No. There's always been a charitable component to the fantasy gifts. And before we established our foundation, the Heart of Neiman Marcus, which supports arts education experiences for children all around the country, it would go to a different charity every year. But that's been going on for long before I started here.
Oh, so does that make the cost of a gift tax deductible?
It depends. If you're paying, for example, the Grammy gift is definitely tax deductible because it's going, the check is being written directly to the Grammy Foundation. And so that makes it tax deductible.
And that's $500,000, right?
$500,000, and $250,000 of that goes to support music education in schools.
So what does this all do, this branding, I guess, for Neiman Marcus and Neiman Marcus Shoppers?
Yes, no, I mean, it is. And again, I think the original idea that Mr. Marcus had was that we could be known as a department store, a luxury department store, where you could buy a $25 lipstick or a his and her airplane. So either one.
There's a range for you.
Yeah.
Ginger, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Ginger Reeder, Vice President of Corporate Communication for Neiman Marcus, where she also curates the famous Fantasy Gifts Collection. She was speaking with Virginia Prescott. And we want to know, what's your fantasy gift? Let us know on Twitter or Facebook. And in case you need a little inspiration, we asked some of the folks on staff here at Word of Mouth to indulge a bit and describe their own fantasy gift ideas. We'll be playing them throughout the show, but here's one to get you started.
What's up, young world? I'm Jimmy Gutierrez. I'm a producer here at Word of Mouth. And my fantasy gift would be, I mean, I dream big, so maybe a 3-day work week. If not, I'd settle for a 4-day work week. You could throw in some sick days, some extra sick days. When I think about gifts or like the big stuff in life, like if I could have anything, I'd have a house, but I wouldn't want someone to give that to me. I'm working for that. So yeah, I guess if there was something, a good gift would be if America got its act together and we had more leisure time. So let's get working by not working.
Coming up after a break, when gifts get smart, or pretend to anyway, we'll talk with our tech expert about the pros and cons of presents that connect to the internet. That's when Word of Mouth's gift show returns in just a minute. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. And we're calling today's show The Gift Show.
This is Molly Donahue. I'm a producer for the Creative Unit. And my fantasy gift, I thought long and hard about this. I couldn't think of anything. And then I was talking with some people and they were like, well, what if you got like a horse or something? And I don't like horses. They scare me. But I did realize that if somebody got me a domesticated fox, I would lose my mind. Because they're so cute and adorable, but they act like dogs, but they're foxes. It would be the most magical gift anyone could give me.
Another staff fantasy gift there. It's the pet you never knew you wanted, but now you're going to be looking that up on Google. Remember, we're looking for your fantasy gifts, so share them on Facebook at facebook.com/wordofmouthradio or on Twitter at wordofmouth. Maybe your fantasy gift is something from the tech aisle, one of those new smart devices on the market, or so-called smart, I should say. From robotic puppies to watches to beds to smoke detectors, objects that are connected to the internet and paired with apps are all over holiday lists. But Rob Fleischman says that not all smart objects really live up to the name. I'll let Virginia pick it up from here.
Really live up to the name. He's principal architect at Akamai and our chief explainer of all things tech. And Rob, I think this is our first show of gift recommendations.
You know, Virginia, it's great to be here, but I will remind you that I have been blessed to be a guest of this show for almost 5 years. And way back in 2012, we talked about the iPod Mini, and we talked about the Surface Pro, and we talked about wearable computers like Google Glass, and we talked about Christmas gifts at the time.
Okay, so it all comes full circle.
That's right. We're back again 4 years later.
But, you know, it doesn't sound like the menu has changed all that much.
Right? You know, you're right. You're right. It's sort of surprising. Even though we're in this tech-heavy world with constant innovation, it's the same old, same old. You know, I mean, look, in 1992, back in the Stone Age, and I must admit I was working on internet technology even back then, Carnegie Mellon University connected a Coke machine to the internet. You know, it was really sort of the first Internet of Things device. And you could tell, you know, what the inventory of the Coke machine was and what drinks were cold, you know, and that was novel. And honestly, we're pretty much doing the same thing, hooking things up to the internet.
Well, let's remind us, please, if you could, like, practically speaking, what are these allegedly smart objects, or they are also referred to as the Internet of Things?
Right. So the idea really is that rather than your laptop or your smartphone, your conventional tablet device, you have common things. Things like thermostats and washing machines and refrigerators, regular old objects hooked up to the internet, giving them some intelligence and remote control, either by a web browser or an app.
Where do you see the utility in a smart gift? You know, like maybe some examples of something that is worth buying or gifting.
Well, you know, I'm a giant infrastructure geek, and I lean toward the practical. So when I think about the Internet of Things, I actually think more in business, you know, things like water temperature and pressure and air temperature and factories and stores for inventory control and those kind of things. So those aren't really gifty things. But as you apply them to yourself, you know, I lean the same way. Things like the very popular Nest thermostat. You know, what a great device. Automatically adapts the temperature of your home for you, can provide graphs and do energy monitoring. And how great that would be for, you know, your remote lake house, so you can see what's going on there remotely without driving up. Those types of devices. You know, cameras. Been a lot of security issues recently with cameras. I think there's going to be a new generation of secure remote cameras. But security and remote viewing is big.
Even inside your refrigerator, from what I understand.
Exactly. Samsung seems to have a great success with this new refrigerator where you can look at what's going on inside. You know, probably helps you with the grocery list, but boy, what a luxury.
I can't imagine it. So what have you seen out there that does maybe not seem like such a good idea? And what would tip you off about that?
Well, you know, we just recently had the Mirai botnet, and, you know, we talked about a local company named Dyn that did some hosting for Reddit and Twitter, and they were attacked by Internet of Things devices. A lot of them were DVRs, cameras, older devices, things like that. And, you know, I'm really worried about low-quality Internet devices. You know, you get some camera for $30 and you hook it up to your Wi-Fi. Well, who are you letting in? You know, what's the security on that? How much technology, how much internet security can you put in a $30 or $40 device that you hook to your network? And now it's inside your network, right? On your private LAN in your house where you're, you know, using your computer to log into your bank accounts, right? So those are the kind of things I'm really wary about.
So are we saying that price point is the greatest indicator of security?
Well, I mean, I could give you an analogy with drones, right? The inexpensive drones these days are toys. You know, if you want a good drone, you're talking a $1,000 price point, buying it from DJI or from one of the high-end drone manufacturers. So that sort of, that really carries over into your toys. You know, if you want an internet-connected device and it costs $30, $40, $50, geez, you know, that's going to be a really low-end device, most likely made in China, most likely not remotely updatable, most likely, you know, third-party manufactured, not the company you're actually buying it from. And it's going to be low quality, something that might be a security problem in a year or two.
Well, I have heard that when it comes to smart objects, they're only as good as their app. Now, what does that mean?
Well, what it means is that, you know, if you can't talk to it, you can't control it, and you can't view it, well, you know, what's the point of having a Wi-Fi enabled thermostat? You know, I mean, if you can't view it and see trends and, you know, really get the utility out of it, all you're doing is, hey, what's the temperature, right? And if it's, hey, what's the temperature? Well, you know, I can walk over and look at the temperature. I don't need a fancy Wi-Fi device to do that.
But you can have an app at work, for example, like, oh, I'm going to go home at 3 o'clock this afternoon instead of the regular time. So I want my heat to be on, and you can control it from your app.
You got it. Exactly. And those are the types of things that you want to see in apps. And things like Nest, you know, they learn. They'll say, wow, you know, Virginia came home yesterday at 3 o'clock, and I noticed on Wednesday she's home at 3. Maybe I'll just learn that, take care of it for her, you know. So those are the kind of things that the higher-end Internet of Things devices have. And you know, it's phenomenal. The growth is phenomenal. I mean, Cisco says by 2030, there'll be 500 billion Internet of Things devices hooked to it. Now, my company, Akamai, we see about 5.5 million new devices a day.
Really?
Yeah. So we have about 22.9 billion today. Our projection is about 50 billion by 2020. So we're, you know, a bit below Cisco, but You know, the number of these devices is just growing phenomenally.
I have to admit, that is stunning to me that that many people have smart devices. But are some of those the kind of business and infrastructure-based things that you were talking about?
You
so not consumer necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, think about how useful this is. You know, you have an old-school factory with temperature gauges all throughout your factory, right? And what do? You got someone walking around looking at the temperature. Well, you know, you hook a little Wi-Fi camera device to that, and now all of a sudden you can remotely see your whole factory. Or, you know, Virginia, you own a network of Panera Breads, right, throughout the country, and you want to understand the air conditioning system at all of them. Are all the temperatures set right? Or maybe the reverse. Maybe it's a maintenance thing. How much power are these air conditioning systems consuming? Wow, look at this one Panera where the air conditioner is consuming twice the amount of power it should. Maybe there's a maintenance issue there. Those are all really useful Internet of Things, remote sensing, remote viewing applications that are really proliferating everywhere because it's inexpensive and makes sense.
Well, if you're looking at holiday gifts, you've probably seen advertisements for smart gifts, watches, robotic puppies, beds, smoke detectors, things that are also called the Internet of Things. And they're connected to the Internet for some reason and paired with apps for your phone or tablets. Well, we're getting some advice today from Rob Fleischman, our chief explainer of all things tech in the allegedly smart gift realm. Well, we're going to pull back from the toys for big kids and go to the toys. This is a smart toy called Talkie that retails for about $60. It's like a little plush stuffed monster that also serves as a voice messenger for kids. So let's hear just a bit from the ad.
Hi, I'm Gori, and I'm a Talkie. Talkies help kids exchange voice messages with their friends and their grown-ups. It's a lot like a tin can telephone, but our messages travel over Wi-Fi, not yarn. Kids have really important things to say, and we make it easy for them to say it.
Ding it, ding it, ding it, ding it.
Plow!
Okay, so...
Oh my goodness.
Are you interested in commenting on the parenting question of whether this is a good idea?
Well, Virginia, the folks at Toy Mail that make this are out of New York, and they're good people, and you know, there's some good technology here, and from my understanding, it's pretty secure, and you know, they allow you to create a network of who could send to and from these devices, but boy, you know, you're buying a device so you can talk to your child through a stuffed animal. That's some interesting stuff. Quite a stretch. Whether I'm lining up to do that, fortunately, my girls are a little older now. You know, they all have iPhones and a myriad of devices to talk to me. But I do need to maybe this would be great. I mean, right now I communicate with them mostly by text. So maybe this would be a way for me to actually speak to them.
You'd hear a voice. So what's on your holiday gift list this year, Rob?
You know, it's been 4 years since we talked about this. And I'm going back, getting another pair of slippers, just like I said in 2012. I think it's time for a new pair.
Rob Fleischman, 5 years of interpreting what eggheads do say think for us here on NHPR. Thanks so much.
Wonderful to be here, Virginia.
I'm Maureen McMurray. I work at Word of Mouth. And for me, fantasy gift would definitely have to be an experience, not like a car or anything like that. I've always wanted to go to Israel, so my fantasy gift would be like a 2-week, all-expenses-paid trip to Israel, first-class flights both ways, and I would want my husband to come along with me. I would also like my daughter to come along with me, but as part of this gift package, I'd want a nanny, so during the day, my husband and my daughter and I could go and see the sights, take in the history, but in the evenings, we could leave her with this like really lovable nanny Mary Poppins type who would watch her and care for her while we went out and had a fancy dinner. So that is my fantasy gift.
Every year, the Jewish Festival of Lights, or Hanukkah, is celebrated around the world for 8 days. Hanukkah starts and ends on a specific day of the Hebrew calendar, and because that doesn't line up with the Gregorian calendar, it shifts around a bit from year to year. This year, Hanukkah lines up with Christmas and New Year's, starting on the evening of December 24th and ending on the evening of January 1st. That close proximity to Christmas can present a conundrum for Jewish parents: how to teach children the meaning of the Festival of Lights when many of their friends are opening a pile of presents on Christmas Day. To find out more, Virginia Prescott spoke with Rabbi Beth Singer. She's the Richard and Rhoda Goldman Senior Rabbi at Congregation Emmanuel in San Francisco.
Rabbi Singer, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be on your show.
So what is the significance of the holiday in the Jewish faith?
So So for the Jewish faith, this is a really old holiday. It's based in a particular period of Jewish history when Jews and many others lived under the rule of a Hellenistic ruler who made a decree that he wanted everyone to observe their culture and religion exactly as he did. And he made it illegal for Jews to do Jewish things. And as the story goes, because these are really stories that come down to us, a small group of Jews rose up and said, no, we want to fight for our right, not for everybody to be Jewish, just for everybody to be the culture and religion that they are. And it was kind of considered a miraculous thing that they were able to overcome this great Greek ruler. And since that time, we celebrate the holiday of Hanukkah, really a celebration of religious freedom and the opportunity for each group to celebrate as we do.
Well, given its economic engine power, Christmas, of course, overwhelms Hanukkah in most cases. But there are some misconceptions. There are some associated customs and traditions surrounding Hanukkah. One, eating fried food, playing with a dreidel. But giving a gift each night is not one of them.
No, it's not. It's not. It's so interesting, Virginia, how it evolved that gift even came to be given, because originally there was no gift giving at Hanukkah. We have a holiday that falls later in the spring called Purim, another miraculous survival holiday, and that was the season of gift giving, but not until the 19th century, as far as we know, in America, where Christmas itself became a much bigger public material holiday. Here in the United States, did Hanukkah start to follow suit a little bit. But many Jewish parents continue to try to create a distinction between Christmas and Hanukkah. And there is a tradition of gift giving or doing good work or giving Hanukkah gelt. That's an old tradition as well. So it is distinct from Christmas.
What's gelt?
Gelt is an old tradition of giving Jewish coins, giving coins for the holiday. And I'm a rabbi, not a historian, but I understand that in Poland in the 17th century, it became a tradition in its time for children to give some coins to their teachers to say thank you, or for poor students to be able to go to wealthier Jewish benefactors who would give them coins. And so there became this association with receiving coins and doing for others, though, of course, children then and now like to receive coins for themselves just to keep, to have some money. And now these days it's sort of a remembrance of gelt, which was real coins, and a particular way of celebrating Hanukkah long ago. You often see these chocolate coins, and people play the game of dreidel, and then they trade these chocolate coins with each other.
Yeah, I've seen them in the stores. Mm-hmm. But I'm very curious about how giving gifts at Hanukkah became a tradition for some Jewish families.
Well, I think that, again, this is the 19th century. The United States was a very different place than it is now. Jews were far less accepted. There had been these huge migrations of Jews from different parts of the world coming to America for economic security or fleeing the Tsar or whatever brought them here. And they really, really wanted to be good citizens, to fit in, to be comfortable for their Christian neighbors, to be comfortable with them. And they saw all of their Christian neighbors observing Christmas, some religiously, but some not so religiously, and exchanging gifts at Christmas time. And my understanding is that some of the Jewish families in that time just thought, well, Hanukkah is a great time to give gifts. Why shouldn't we give gifts? And it's so not a Jewish tradition originally that every family does it differently. There are families who give their children a gift each of the eight nights, and there are some that give their children, you know, one or two little gifts. When I was growing up, our family gave us, you know, one really nice gift at some point during Hanukkah, like a Barbie doll, and then a book one night and some pajamas the other night, and that was Hanukkah. And increasingly now what I really love is a lot of families take at least one or a number of the eight nights of Hanukkah and use it to go volunteer in a soup kitchen or to wrap up gifts to give other families who don't have presents and to do some form of good giving to others to celebrate the miracle of Hanukkah.
What do you recommend, though, for families who say, you know, Rabbi Beth, I'm not comfortable giving gifts to my kids for Hanukkah. Seems like we were pressured into it to fit in or something.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I think every family has this wonderful opportunity in the time we're living in to develop their own Hanukkah traditions. You know, when is your family going to light the Hanukkah menorah? Are you going to put it in the window? That's a very great Jewish tradition to proclaim the miracle publicly, not to be afraid to be Jewish in the times we're living in, even though we're a minority here in the United States of America. And families, I think you have to start when your kids are really little. If they want to use these holidays to teach values to their children, they can say, you know, in our family, we do different things. Maybe we each get a book at Hanukkah, or we go and we do a lot of volunteer work during Hanukkah, and they really downplay the presents. They do a lot with Hanukkah menorah lighting. We gave each of our children their own Hanukkah menorah, so every Hanukkah, there were five of these in our window, and everybody was lighting their own, and our kids were excited. But it is difficult because, you know, they have peer pressure, and I think all families have to deal with that peer pressure. Well, we're very excited for our Christian friends that they have Christmas as a tradition. We have a different tradition. I think it's great to go celebrate Christmas with Christians in their home. I think that's another wonderful way, and to do presents with them in a Christian home, because that's a Christmas tradition.
Well, Rabbi Singer, thank you for speaking with us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you. Rabbi Beth Singer is the senior rabbi at Congregation Emmanuel, a synagogue in San Francisco.
I am Taylor Quimby, senior producer of Word of Mouth. My fantasy gift would be an entire music studio, complete with cool guitars, banjos, other stringed instruments, like recording gear, cool pedals, everything. Also a space, so like an extra room in my apartment would somehow have to be built. And also, I would need to have the time to be able to play it, so that gift would need to come with like several months off from the job, like kind of a sabbatical sort of thing. And then maybe also like a person who's always there to help me use all this stuff that I don't know how to actually use. I guess my fantasy gift would be a full music studio in my apartment with a full-time employee and several months off from work. So that was my fantasy gift. Wasn't really holding back much. We want yours too, so share them on our Facebook page or on Twitter. We all know how giving gifts can get a little competitive. Coming up, a gift-giving tradition where Native Americans would literally give away the roof over their heads. That story when Word of Mouth continues.
Hi, I'm Logan Shannon. I'm one of the producers for Word of Mouth. And my fantasy gift would be having my husband take me on an amazing trip, but taking care of everything. And I know nothing about it. So I wake up in the morning and my bags are all packed. Everything's been taken care of. Work knows that I'm going on this trip and the time has been taken off. And he just takes me to the airport and doesn't tell me where we're going. And we land in an amazing place, like, I don't know, Iceland or Ireland. And everything is just absolutely taken care of, and I have done nothing to plan it, but it is perfect. But I would also settle for a really great pair of woolly, fluffy socks.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. One of our last staff fantasy gifts there, and one that might actually be doable compared to some of the others. Now, we all know that holiday gift-giving can, unintentionally, get a little competitive, which isn't exactly the spirit of this season, but there are worse things to fight about. Here to tell us the story of one gift-giving tradition that really went above and beyond is Backstory with the American History Guys. Here they are, Ed Ayers, Brian Ballow, and Peter Onuf.
In 1886, a young anthropologist named Franz Boas showed up in a village on America's northwest coast, and he witnessed an extravagant feast. It was held in a cedar house with 50-foot ceilings and carved columns depicting the figures of ancestors.
They were wearing huge masks of birds and supernatural beings, and singing songs. He'd never been exposed to this kind of music before, with these very complex syncopated rhythms.
This is Isaiah Wilner, a historian who is writing a new biography of Boaz. He explains that the ritual Boaz saw among the Kwakwaka'wakw Indians was known as a potlatch, and it could get a little out of hand.
They would throw so much oil on the fire that the flames would actually lick the beams, and then the attendants would have to scurry up to douse the beams with water so that the house wouldn't burn down.
But Boaz was especially struck by one particular aspect of this ritual. The chiefs of all tribes present would make a grand spectacle of giving their stuff away. A lot of stuff, prized blankets, huge amounts of salmon meat and fish oil, and treasured copper shields that bore their chiefly titles. And just about everybody there went home with a share of the loot.
The hereditary chiefs are competing for a reputation of greatness, and the reputation is based upon their ability to distribute goods to the people.
These competitions of giving were held at weddings, funerals, and holidays. When a chief couldn't give enough away to sufficiently shame a rival, he might make a show of destroying his precious items to show how little he regarded them.
So a great chief would burn canoes, he would rip blankets, but at the end of his life, after he had given all of these potlatches, after he had been through as many as four marriages, after he had given away his names and titles, he finally would potlatch the roof of his house, and he'd just be sitting there exposed to the stars, and he would die a poor but happy man. And this impressed Boaz greatly.
Boaz would go on to become a towering figure in American anthropology. But at the time, he hardly spoke the native language, and so he didn't realize that what he was seeing, with fire licking the rafters and destroying canoes, was a totally amped-up version of the potlatch. In the couple of decades before he arrived, life for the Pacific Northwest Indians had become increasingly desperate. The latest smallpox outbreak had wiped out half the population. Christian missionaries were trying to root out native traditions. The canning industry was moving in and taking control of Indian waterways. And as a response to these pressures, the centuries-old tradition of reciprocal gift-giving had gone into overdrive.
Here's why. For one thing, it created a way for vacant offices to be filled by commoners who were able to potlatch their way through the ranks. And in this time of crisis, it also served as a means by which the community could take care of its own.
You know, the level of poverty that we have in our society, the level of inequality that we accept as normal, that would have been a great source of shame to a chief of the Northwest Coast. And in fact, if a chief of the Northwest Coast couldn't provide for his people, there was someone else who was willing to take his place and would be able to do it through the potlatch.
But there was something else, something more profound. In a society where everything would ultimately be shared, there was little incentive for people to strip all they could for themselves from the natural world. And so the potlatch was in many ways a celebration of restraint, of saying, we are greater than our material desires.
So the Kwakwaka'wakw, you know, their most fearsome spirit was Bach Bach Willinuxaway, and he was a spirit covered with mouths, and he was always hungry. And so the potlatch was a way of acting out the human struggle with hunger and saying that the only way we can really be civilized is if we say, enough, we don't have to take everything.
If we say, let's celebrate what we do have by giving it away.
That was Isaiah Wilner speaking with Backstory with the American History Guys. That story comes to us from a whole special they did about gift giving and the history of charity in America. We've got a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, it's just about the tail end of our gift-giving show, so a perfect time to talk about one of the final steps in the process, wrapping. I'll let Virginia take over from here.
Whether you choose the Sunday funnies, an elaborate printed paper festooned with glitter and snowflakes, or a shiny bag stuffed with tissue, you will likely practice the time-honored ritual of concealing holiday gifts in some fashion this season. It's estimated that Americans spend upwards of $3 billion a year on gift wrap, most of which is then ripped off and thrown away. Jude Stewart is a journalist who covers design and visual culture, and we've invited her to talk about the history of gift wrapping. Jude, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So when did this tradition of wrapping gifts in decorative paper begin?
Well, it went back way further than I had expected when I looked into this. We're talking 2nd century BC in the southern Song Dynasty of ancient China. Government officials would get their end-of-the-year bonus wrapped up in a piece of paper, a little envelope called qi po. So this is really, you could call it wrapping paper. It's made of hemp, bamboo fibers, and rice straws. And then you have, a little bit later on, Japanese invented something called a furushiki, which is a traditional reusable wrapping cloth. And they still use those today. They're very beautiful. And collectible. And then the Koreans have their own version, which is called bojaji, and it's a traditional wrapping cloth made of silk. So moving forward to the present, you have the Industrial Revolution. The Christmas card was invented in the West in 1843, and then you have a lot more paper products of all kinds being created as printing techniques kind of improved. So the Victorians were really big on Christmas paper. But then really when it became a mass market phenomena was in 1917. And as the story, possibly apocryphal but very entertaining, goes, there were two brothers, J.C. and Raleigh Hall, who ran a stationery store in Kansas City. And they were using at the time what everyone was using, which was tissue paper. So like a green or red or white tissue paper, and they ran out of it. And so they went to the back of the store and found some paper that was sort of heavy paper used to line envelopes and not typically used as wrapping paper. And they just put it out for 10 cents and it sold like hotcakes, sold like wrapping paper, in fact. And so they kept doing this year after year and realized they were onto something, and that paper that was differentiated and didn't look like every other retailer's was indeed a market. So those guys went on to found Hallmark.
Ah, okay. It's all making sense now. So those illustrations of traditional Victorian Christmas with brightly wrapped and beautifully wrapped toys under the tree or packages under the tree, this is an invention?
No, I wouldn't say that's true, but maybe it wasn't as widespread as it is today. It was more of an upper-class phenomenon. Those papers were very heavy quality, and if they were created before the inventions of printing press, you know, became really cheap and affordable, then yes, it would be quite expensive to get that paper. So not everybody had that under their tree.
You've covered design for quite a while. You've written books about color and pattern. What is that appeal of a beautifully wrapped gift? I mean, there's a reason why Martha Stewart is so popular, right? That we can't seem to shake this pretty much wasteful practice of wrapping gifts.
Well, sure. I think it marks a moment. You know, you receive something from someone. They usually put it right in your hands, although, you know, increasingly that may not be the case. But you get this thing, and it's meant for you, and it's from someone who's thought about you and tried to give you this special thing. And then you have the moment where you can't immediately get to it, you know, so you have to tear into it. And I think in some crazy way, the destruction aspect of it is part of the fun. I have a 3-year-old son, so I know it's core to the fun for him. And then, you know, at the bottom of it, you have this wonderful surprise. So it takes a little more time, and that's maybe part of it. Interestingly, I was looking around, and there's a psychological sort of marketing study that happened in the early 90s that confirms a lot of the things I think we all understand intuitively, that people prefer wrapped gifts to unwrapped gifts, and the nicer the wrapping, the more they do prefer that as well. So and also that it's resonating with all the previous times that you've gotten a gift and you've had this moment. So, you know, when you're in the guest opening moment, you're channeling back to your childhood in a sense and all the gifts you've ever gotten.
Yeah, I'm such a sucker for it. I almost bought $11.50 adorable wrapping paper with little otters on it last night to wrap a $3 gift.
I think you might need to go get that. Maybe you should just give them the wrapping paper, buy two.
I'm actually wondering about that. But it does just get thrown away. So do you have suggestions for wrapping things beautifully and responsibly?
Well, I mean, first off, you have to buy the post-consumer recycled paper. So there's, you know, that I think we all know is go out there and, you know, shop responsibly. But then there's other ways to play it. So you mentioned the Sunday comics. That's a wonderful way to reuse newspaper and get some kind of fun and accidental effects on the package. You never know what's going to show up on the top. I have, as I said, a small child, and, you know, a really fun activity is to wrap something in a completely plain piece of paper, like an uncoated paper, and then have your child scribble all over it. Probably you could do that in reverse order, have them draw the picture and then use the large piece of paper to wrap something. So that is meaningful, and meaningful enough potentially that someone might cut neatly along the seams and keep the wrapping paper as well.
Do you have any go-to advice for wrapping presents, you know, any sort of tips you've learned through the years?
I wouldn't say I'm a professional wrapper. I am more interested in the patterns and the colors than I am in actually producing a fantastic product, I got to be honest. But for me, I really like making it into a process. I like sitting down, have a big stack of unwrapped things, and then all the papers, and pour yourself a nice big drink, sit by the fire, and you know, do it with someone you love, and then it becomes its own moment in itself, wrapping and unwrapping. Oh, pro tip. Do you know about when you take the side of the scissors and you run it over the ribbon to make a curl?
I have seen
that.
That's
exciting.
Okay, how about for those awkwardly shaped presents? I mean, the corners, getting them right.
I mean, part of the fun of wrapping something really unusually shaped, I think, is just owning it. So, you know, getting into really tiny little sculptural pieces of paper and following the line really closely can be its own fun exercise. It makes for a very crazy patchwork worth of paper. But the point here is beauty, but also effort. So to show that you really put some thought into this and that you're trying to make this thing and that you get the joke that this is, it's ridiculous to wrap this odd-shaped thing of paper, but yet you tried really hard anyway.
Jude Stewart, she's author of Patternalia, an unconventional history of polka dots, stripes, plaid, camouflage, and other graphic patterns. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
You'll find a link to learn more at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we'd like to know how you plan to wrap your gifts this season. You can share a photo of your skills on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouth.
So there's just one fantasy gift left. Host Virginia Prescott saved just a little bit of her voice to offer us this one.
I would like to go back to the Camino de Santiago. This is this pilgrimage trail with tentacles all over Europe. And I've done one leg of it for 3 weeks, starting in Narbonne in France, crossing over the Pyrenees into Spain. I made it with companion to Logroño, and I think I could do it in about 3.5 or 4 more weeks. So I'd need that time off of work, and I would love to schedule like stints of walking it with friends of mine or people who are very dear to me. There's something wonderful about walking alongside somebody. You have different conversations than you would if you were staring at each other across a table. And for me, having that experience of doing it with somebody I love is a tradition I want to carry on and share with more people. Yeah, so I want to go back to the Camino de Santiago, and I want someone to organize it so I can meet my friends on stops along the way. And then together we'll walk and get really bad blisters. Everybody gets really bad blisters.
That was the last fantasy gift on staff here at Word of Mouth. So part of the team is in the studio with me now. I've got Jimmy, Logan, and Maureen in the studio. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hello.
And I thought this was sort of an interesting exercise. I feel like it ended up being a really weird sort of Rorschach test because we didn't put any parameters on what a fantasy gift was. And so you saw like Jimmy and I going pretty weird with it. Like we went pretty far. You guys went with trips that are actually realistic and doable.
I only asked for my trip, I said 2 weeks. Now that I'm going back, like that's actually kind of strange that I, if it's a fantasy gift, I mean, in reality, I would like to spend 3 months there. But why didn't I ask for it? Why don't I think I'm worth more than 2 weeks? Yeah, it's weird. I went like realistic.
I thought the same thing. I was like, yeah. take like a, you know, Taylor's out of 3 months.
I think that I'm a pretty pragmatic person. And so when I hear fantasy, I'm like, well, throw that out the window. Let's go nuts.
Let's have a robot that works for free in your studio.
Yeah, robot would be better than unpaid human employee.
Right.
I mean, I think that's the point you're making is you're like, I just want this to be taken care of. Not that you want, you know, an indentured servant to, like, handle your studio.
Yeah, that's yeah. another theme. Well, everybody sort of wanted something, but they didn't want to have to deal with the logistics.
Yes. And wanted the time. Time was a big factor, too, mm-hmm. of having mm-hmm. time to explore, time to do things. And maybe we need more time in our lives.
Yeah. Yeah, the only person actually who didn't include some sort of time was the domesticated fox from Mali.
But I'll point out to you that if she gets a domesticated fox, she's taking time off from work to hang out with the fox. Like, that's just sort of a given.
Yeah, 3-day work week would be pretty sweet if you had a fox.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hers is the most magical.
So, since this is sort of our holiday seasonal show, are there any last profound thoughts before we go about gifts, or maybe not so much a fantasy gift as a normal reality gift that could be really nice?
The thread of all of ours was that we would want someone who could help us do things. So maybe the best gift that you can give someone is to help them and give them the time. So if you have someone who has children, perhaps you could offer to watch that child. Mom.
Nudge, nudge.
Yeah, geez.
Or, yeah, just give someone, or if you're an employer, give your employee some time off.
Or maybe if you just want to be nice to some neighbors, it's like shoveling the walk and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, save them some time.
All right. Happy holidays.
Oh, happy holidays,
happy
Taylor.
Holidays.
Happy holidays.
I don't know the words to that.
It's something, may the something something, while the merry bells keep ringing.
Thanks for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from Poddington Bear and David Sestay. Don't forget to share your fantasy gifts with us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. And check out a really cool video on how to wrap a gift origami style without tape or ribbon. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Since time is the best gift, we're giving you the gift of the Word of Mouth podcast, which can be listened to anytime, be it noon or 3 a.m. You can find that by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Still a few days to get your gifts ready. Either way, Word of Mouth will be back tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue, Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.
It's actually
happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
May the calendar keep ringing. Happy holidays to you.